Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the club's Arts Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our program today is Book Arts Today, Amazing Intersections of All Kinds. Delicious, provocative, incredible but rarely edible works of art, guides to literacy among the many appropriate tags for what's going on in today's world of book arts. Our distinguished panel of Bay Area book artists will discuss the traditional and contemporary intersections that are accessible in today's world. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Emily McVarish, Charles Hobson, Penny Nee, and Michael Bartolos. Today's panel will be moderated by Emily McVarish, who is a faculty of graphic design at the California College of the Arts and also the publisher of her own press, owner of her own press. And Emily will take it from here. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you all for coming. I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to discuss current and local developments in the area of artist books with such a distinguished panel and discerning audience. I say developments in the area of artist books because artist books are not easily or even productively pinned down. They are, by definition, a hybrid form, what Dick Higgins called an intermedial form. A book is just a book until you attend to its combination of material, visual, spatial, and temporal dimensions. It is this attention that distinguishes artist books from conventional books. We're conditioned by convention to ignore the form of the book, to approach it as a mere vehicle for the delivery of content. By engaging us in experiences of a book's capacity to integrate form and content, by demonstrating the dynamics that link seeing and reading, materiality and poetics, sequence and cognition, artist books awaken us from the sleep of convention. This awakening has been aided in the last 20 years by the arrival of new media which have vied to displace the book in more and more of its roles. This shift has brought critical and theoretical scrutiny to the form of the book from fields of inquiry that never before took it into account. It has also provoked creative exploration of the form on an unprecedented scale. Precisely because artist books cross boundaries, because they embed the textual in the concrete, because they multiply the image, because they defy distinctions between making and publishing, because they tend to fall between the realms of exhibition and distribution, and because they spring from impulses and contexts as diverse as those of traditional crafts and conceptual art, the history of artist books has mainly been confined to the margins of mainstream criticism and awareness. Yet those margins have been expanded recently by technological change, and that history has come to unfold a new generation of interest in the book as an expressive medium. Fortunately for newcomers, places like the San Francisco Center for the Book exist to introduce anyone interested to the questions and techniques that guide bookmaking through classes, exhibitions, and other public programming. Places like the center have also been crucial to the work of committed book artists, insofar as they've supported ever more attuned dialogue surrounding the nature and potential of artist books and their place in the broader culture. Today, there are centers for book arts in many cities around the country and the world. But in San Francisco, we are in the enviable position of having a center that can draw on a rich array and lineage of book work stemming from poetry, printing, graphic arts, and information design. From the Beats of North Beach to the researchers of Xerox Park, the Bay Area has been seminal in the area of book thought and experimentation. With us today are three artists whose work constellates this broad area and whose perspectives will serve as points of departure for our discussion of contemporary book art in the Bay Area and beyond. Michael Bartolos in the middle is a graphic artist whose work includes, I'm going to show some images. This is Michael's. I'll show a couple of each of the artists. Whose work includes limited edition prints and artist books and sculptural assemblage. He designed the Latin jazz stamp issued last year by the U.S. Postal Service. Michael was also the first artist in residence at the San Francisco Center for the Book. Next up is Charles Hobson. Charles is a renowned book artist whose work is archived at Stanford University Libraries. He is an associate professor in printmaking at the San Francisco Art Institute, and since 1986 has run Pacific Editions, which publishes artist books. Is this still Charles? That too is Charles. Penny Nee, by my side, has been a computer scientist, a researcher in the field of artificial intelligence, this is Penny, and a gallerist. In addition to producing the content of her widely exhibited books, she engineers book structures that can be viewed as sculptures. So thank you all for participating. I'm going to ask each of the panelists a couple of questions just to get the conversation started. But we'd also love to hear from you, so I'm going to make sure to leave plenty of time at the end for your questions. I'd like to begin by asking each of you, what drew you to artist books as a medium? Was there a particular piece, experience, influence, motivation, orientation that got you involved in this field? And I'd like to start with you, Charles.
Thank you, Emily. I had a friend die, and a group of his friends made a small book published at a poetry press in Berkeley of his writing. And it was an epiphany for me because I saw that a human being could make a book. And until that time, I had assumed books were in another universe of human activity than what I was interested in. But there were elements of design and beauty even in this small book that we were able to do as a memorial to my friend. And in a way, his death gave me this this path that I've been on now for 25 years.
Wow. Penny, how about you?
Well, in the mid-1990s, I was looking for something to do that combined my interest in writing, art making, and at the same time that combined some analytical thinking because of my background. I had just retired from Stanford as a research scientist. And so, in a way, I was looking for a mentor for a new kind of life. And this search was quite hard. And one day, a friend told me about the Center for the Book Arts. It had just begun. And I met Steve Woodall, who until recently was the artistic director there. And he was, or is, a poet. And he said, well, he can look at my writing. And I made an arrangement with the center that I would think up of some project, and they would find me teachers to teach me all the skills I needed. And I was lucky to have Coriander Riesborg as my first teacher, and she opened up a huge new world for me, like, you know, how you make wheat paste. I mean, who knew anything other than Elmer's glue? Or how to make book cloth out of old pieces of kimono that I wanted to use. And so that took care of sort of the writing and the sort of making part. But then there was this thing that I really wanted to do, which was to sort of make use of the way that I can think in analytical terms, because that was my training. And in 1999, I was asked to be one of the jurors at San Jose Museum of Quilts and Textile, where they were doing an exhibition called Out of Time, to celebrate the millennium. So instead of showing a quilt, I decided I'll make a book. And as you know, quilts exhibited on the wall, so then I decided I'll make a book that hung on the wall. Now, recently, Howard Munson has come up with what he calls vertical book, which is an accordion fold that you can hang up on the wall. But at that time, I just really thought, what is a book that can hang on a wall you'd like? And so what I came up with was the first slide you show. It's a book that, when you open it, contains an accordion-folded book, basically. And then you stretch it out with the right edge, and it becomes an object. And that object is strong enough to be hung on the wall. So I think this was the beginning of my journey in the world of book art, to think about book form that have functional purpose. More specifically, think of book structure as an integral part of the narrative. Mm-hmm. And so many people have inspired me, but I think the person who really encouraged me in my approach was Kumi Kov. She is a print artist, a book artist, and she's also an architect. So when she thinks about her books, she thinks in three dimensions, and that's how I would like to think about my books. And then the other inspirations come from children's books. You know, there are many innovative children's book structures, and also from packaging designers. Mm-hmm. I think they all make really interesting use of surfaces and the form. Mm-hmm. And that's been my inspiration.
Wow, that's really interesting. How about you, Michael?
Well, I think I owe my love for book arts to a fascination with multiples from early childhood. I remember actually going down the grocery store aisles with my mom and looking at the long row of Brillo pads or like Lucky Charms and just the fact that there were so many of them. And part of it might have been this innate need for pattern that, you know, humans always look for. Another might have been the reassurance that there'll be enough Brillo to last us a lifetime. But I was always interested in multiples. And then when I was in art school, a teacher of mine, Barbara Nessem, who went on to become the chair of the illustration department at Parsons and FIT before that, in between Pratt and Parsons, specifically gave us a book arts assignment. She said, you're going to make a little 4x4 book, which happens to be the same size that we do small plates editions at the center for the book. Everything comes around. And I was just so into this. I was like, I can make a book. It's kind of going back to what Charles said. I thought that that just existed somewhere in another world where it was inaccessible and only machines and factories did that. And that kind of set me on my path. And then a year out of school, I met Esther Smith and Dick O'Faust at Purgatory Pie Press, and we started working pretty intensely together for a series of years, and I took it from there.
Wow, this is going to be a great panel. I mean, such a rich combination of experiences and sort of perspectives. What you said about the pleasure of repetition and the multiple, that totally rings true to me. Mm-hmm. Also, the power of what you both talked about, of making a book and that first experience, which I think a lot of people have at the center for the book, and probably, you know, explains a lot about why anybody makes books. What you were saying, Penny, about children's books and packaging and sort of taking inspiration from them, I'm going to shut up because I really want to hear more from you, but I'm just stimulated by what you guys have said, and that because I think there's so many. It goes back to what I was saying about all these dimensions of the book that are not tapped by conventional book design. Children's books, for whatever reason, have been allowed certain transgressions in design and this typography and mixtures of words and images that trade publishing for the most part does not indulge in. And meanwhile, packaging shares so much fundamentally with book form, and yet there's never any crossover in mass book production between packaging design and book design. So all of these are, I think, really, they make sense to me. They definitely resonate to me as sources of book thought and book art. Okay, so I have a range of questions now, which I'm going to direct to you individually, but I want to invite you all to chime in and weigh in if what someone says provokes a comment. We have time, and I hope we will have some back and forth. But I want to start again with you, Charles. Can you describe a specific piece or a practice that exemplifies your approach, the relationship between content and form, or content and structure in your books?
Yes, I brought a book that I've done called Taking Off Emily Dickinson's Clothes by Billy Collins, former poet laureate, and you'll notice as I open it that I'm actually kind of undressing something. I mean, I've got to take parts of it apart. And as the book opens, The poem begins, and I'll just pick up with one of the phrases in the poem. The complexity of women's undergarments in 19th century America is not to be waved off, and I proceeded like a polar explorer through clips and clasps and moorings, catches, straps, and whalebone stays, sailing toward the iceberg of her nakedness. Now, in order to read the rest of the book, you have to untie and unbutton. You're a little nervous when you do this. The page. And he goes on, later I wrote in a notebook, it was like riding a swan into the night, but of course I cannot tell you everything. So I use this book almost religiously in explaining to someone what I think an artist's book is, because I hope in this brief little explication you've seen that the use of various, it's not just the words on the page, and it's not just an image next to the page. I should point out that the last line reads, "So I could plainly hear her inhale when I undid the very top hook and eye fastener of her corset, and I could hear her sigh when finally it was unloosed, the way some readers sigh when they realize that hope has feathers, that reason is a plank, that life is a loaded gun that looks right at you with a yellow eye." So this image, which is taken from a Degas photograph from 1874, contains a feather being sewn onto it, which, of course, is a function of that last line. And this is kind of where I started with the book design, but was unsatisfied with it because it didn't have enough connection to the sense of the text. And so it was on a Sunday afternoon that I realized I just tried sewing some pages together and got that, saw that it worked, and it was the thing that launched the book. And there is, of course, in the back, another little feather link, which is from Emily Dickinson. "Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all."
So I'm just bouncing off a couple of things that you showed us. Taking advantage of the fundamental physicality of the book, I mean, when I said that we're just conditioned to just look for what the text says and not see how we're accessing the text in a conventional book, accessing it through this very physical, kinetic object, and by emphasizing the fact that a book opens at the, and that there's a disclosure in that, and working that so beautifully into the poetry of that text, it is an excellent example of the integration that artist books are usually about.
I would echo what you're saying, and I think that the part of it for me that was miraculous was these things didn't happen all at once. It wasn't sitting down at a table and saying, oh, I'm going to design this book this afternoon. It started out, it probably took 6 or 8 months of kind of gestation for it to come together until that afternoon when I found the button design. I will say that I have this little rubric that I repeat frequently, that I think books as an expressive medium have four qualities. That if you're thinking about a painting, for example, it has certain qualities, or sculpture has certain qualities. Well, the book as an expressive medium has four qualities that I think are dominant. One is you have sequence. One thing comes before another. So that almost without intention will create a narrative flow. And then there is this other thing I call flow, which is not necessarily the sequence, but that how one page can hold one word, the next page can hold words to the brim, or there can be a small image on one page and then no image on the next and then a large image, so that you get a kind of almost music from that turning of the pages. Then you have word and image that go together. If they're done well, it's 1 + 1 = 3. If it's done poorly, it's 1 + 1 = 1/2. And finally, there's structure. I mean, you're making handmade books mostly, so you can put yourself in the seat of making a book that seems almost impossible. But and then you find ways to make it in more than one copy. I will say, just as a point, that I is that the Chronicle Books in San Francisco mm-hmm. has sort of gone against the tide mm-hmm. of routine book design, and that you can see any number of books that they have done that have taken advantage of so many of these qualities that I just pointed out.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Yeah, please, Penny.
Well, since you listed what you think are sort of the characteristics, I wanted to add one or a couple of things, which is that in books, unlike watching movies, which are also narratives and so on, sequential and so on, you can pace yourself. That is, you can go slowly or you can go fast, you can skip over things. So the information you get out of the book is at your own pace, the way you want it. You can stop and pick it up later. And the other thing I think, since I've been talking about books in electronic age, people seem really married to the idea of the texture, that is, paper. And somehow the feel of your tactile feel is really important. So that's just addition to mm-hmm. what you said.
Thanks. That's great. I have a question now for you, Michael. Mm-hmm. But again, feel free, others, to weigh in. Since you're a graphic artist in many media, what does the book form allow you to do specifically? So, as distinct from the other media that you work in as a graphic artist?
Well, that's pretty easy. I think it really allows me to work with my hand because these days digital design, graphic design is 90% digitally created, at least my work is. And it's a real pleasure to get back to, as our two other panelists were saying, tactile experience, you know, work with textures, work with materials, work in three dimensions as opposed to a two-dimensional flat surface or even offset print media. You'll be working in two dimensions, and you'll have a piece of paper with stuff printed on it. With letterpress, for example, I almost see that as three dimensions already because you've pressed the ink into the paper and you've created a texture on this flat piece of paper, not to mention the sculptural aspects of bookmaking. So that's what book arts affords me as a graphic artist, an opportunity to experiment in three dimensions and with my hands. But actually, I also want to mention that book arts also appeals to me because of the graphic arts aspects that I can bring into it. For example, I love working with type, letter forms, layouts, compositions, the flow of the narrative, and all of that is inherent in good graphic design and good graphic arts to begin with. And so I can bring all that to the table when I'm working on these artist books and really create something new on a higher level than I could have otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Does anybody else want to, since you both also...
Do you feel that the digital form operates differently in your mind than what I call the analog form, the actual writing or layouts? Do you draw some of your stuff before you get it in the computer?
I do, and I don't know if that's because the computer came around after I had come out of school already. When I was in school, we weren't working on computers yet. So I was trained to draw by hand and think in hand sketches. That may be a reason. But yes, I'm very comfortable working that way and then taking my stuff into the digital realm. And if I may just add one more thing.
Please.
On that subject, one of the wonderful things is that we can combine the two technologies. We have letterpresses on one hand, but then we're making our photopolymer plates from digital files created in Illustrator, Photoshop, or what have you. So it's not one or the other. It's a really incredible combination of both and all its permutations.
Indeed. That leads me right into my next question, which is for Penny. In what sense, Penny, are you and your work invested in expanding the boundaries of artist books, and how do you see the role of digital media in this expansion, since we're talking about digital media?
Well, can my answer be a little long?
Of course. Take your time. Take your time, Penny.
It's a big question.
It is a big question.
Actually, I want to get into this by the, actually, it's the third slide picture, uh-huh. which is over there, which is a book called Totality. Now, that book, Totality, is in two parts. The first part is a story I wrote that was experiencing total eclipse in Bolivia. And I think my husband and I are kind of eclipse chaser, but we missed the one that Mary made it to, which is the longest one of the 21st century. But in any case, so I wrote this story, and it's laid out, the text is laid out on sort of watercolor impressions that I did of eclipse. Then the second part is I spend a lot of time collecting stories about eclipse in history, in myth, in literature, and in newspapers. And so I put those on a round kind of piece of paper disc, and on the back of each of these stories, I sort of drew the paths of past eclipse and non-eclipse, future eclipse. Now, I'm very frustrated with this book, and so I'm going to talk about what the hope I have that the future is going to help me with my frustrations. And so I'll just go through my three things. So how many of you have seen Total Eclipse? Okay, great. So you know what it's like. But the story describes stages of the sun being eaten away. So you watch the sun, and then it starts to disappear. And just before the sun becomes a black hole, a black disk, there are a couple of phenomena that occur. One is called Bailey's beads, where there's a sequence of lights, and then as the sun goes behind this disk, which is moon, it has a flare. It's called the diamond ring. Now, unless you've seen that, it's really hard to express it. That is, I don't think my writing in that is very bad. I think it's pretty good, actually. But I wish my book had a visual. That is, I can have a video that goes with while the person is reading or being read to. And sort of the other part is similar, wish that technology would solve, which is that there's an amazing coincidence that we live on Earth that allows for the total eclipse to happen, which is that the sun is about 400 times further than the moon from relative to us. And the sun happens to be about 400 times the size of a moon. So for us, they look similar. They're about the same size. And so when they sort of cross paths, then you can see the radiation of the sun called the corona. So if you were on Mars, is that further away or closer or further, then you wouldn't see that effect. Or if you were further away, then you'd just see a little black pinpoint. Now, it's really hard. You remember in school learning about the moon rotating around the Earth and the Earth rotating around the sun and how the phases of the moon occur. And I found when I heard about that or learned it, very difficult to understand without some visualization. So I would like to see that visually as well, as part of the effect of the thing. And the second one, well, let me go through it quickly. As the sun disappears and it gets darker, it's like dusk. And then you see a 360-degree sunset. Now, since we're used to seeing just sunset only one side, it's really to imagine that you look around and there's sunset everywhere. So if we can have an image on a book that you touch and simulate you're rotating around and seeing the horizon, and it would, as a bonus, the room when dimmed down would be great.
I love this. It's a visionary book. It's just really is developing in my mind.
So then the other thing has to do with the supplemental information about all my books have the supplemental things because I do research and I find things and I want to share that. But for example, just real quickly, there was an eclipse that occurred, recorded February 17, 478 BC. So in a particular part in Turkey, which is part of the Persian Empire. And Xerxes, the Persians had waged war in Greece, and that person was Xerxes. I don't exactly know if that's right. But when the eclipse happened, he was told that this is great omen for the destruction of Greece. So he went to war, and of course that was a disaster. And after a few of them, he was assassinated by his generals. But the point is that that's about all I could put on the small disk. Now, if that disk was, I could touch it and it would connect to the internet, so that if the book connected to the internet, then I could find out all of these things while I was looking at the book. So that's what I see as a future, that I can rewrite that book and all my frustrations will go away with technology, and it would help me with my book.
Well, that's a great example of intermedia. I mean, the idea of a book as an intersection between the capacities of different media to communicate things. I think we have a little bit more time, just maybe time for one more question before I go to the audience questions, which are fascinating, so we're definitely going to get to them. Charles, for you, since I know you teach and have been teaching for some time at the Art Institute, as a fellow teacher, I'm interested in this myself. Has the nature of your students' interest in the book as an art form changed over the years? And what would you say is the currency? What do you get from that in terms of understanding of the currency of the book as an art form?
Well, I think what's happened is there has been a broadened interest throughout the San Francisco Art Institute. And I think that that represents maybe something that's happening in the broader world, which is as the electronic means of communication broaden, and we're beset with everything from Kindles to Sony readers and so on, that there's a growing recognition that a handmade book with its own tactile sensations and the fact that a set of human hands put it together carries with it almost some mystical power.
Mm-hmm.
And that in some ways, it's never been a better time for the book arts than it is right now.
That authenticity that students are drawn to in the made, in the handmade, I definitely see that in my letterpress students as well. It's just it's fascinating to watch. I think it's a great counterpoint to what Penny was saying about the potential of books to embrace other media. But Michael, you were going to say something.
Oh, I was just going to say it's quite a paradox that book arts is embraced in this hyper-digital age, because I always expect students to kind of brush it off as like old school, and then they're just so into it, and it's just really gratifying to see.
And this is true at the Center for the Book, where many of the students in the letterpress classes are coming from, they're digital designers. They're working in design all day long, and then they're ravenous to get their hands physically on metal type.
Yeah, have that experience.
There's another element in the school situation which I find interesting, is that if you take the effort to make a book with your work as an expressive component of your work, you can go back to your painting, your photography, your video documentation, whatever your main medium is, the focus that a book puts on the subject increases your whole artistic sensibility.
Hmm.
And that's one reason that the Art Institute, I think, it's gotten such prominence, because people are seeing that they may not become book artists, but they certainly can use that in encouraging their ideas to expand.
That's really interesting. I believe that.
Do we have time? Can I inject one more?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, also I wanted to point out that storytelling is so innate in all of us. You know, this is something that, is part of humanity. And books may change their form, they change their medium, technology may change but storytelling will always be there. And the book form is really the ultimate vehicle for this. And it really amazes me sometimes where even if you have an accordion fold book and you have these seemingly disparate images lined up from left to right, people will still look for connections between these images. You know, we'll look for a sequence, a connection, something. We compare the images to one another. And this is really another thing that drew me personally into the book form is I love stories. I love storytelling. And I use this medium for that reason.
Uh-huh. I see Anne.
Well, no, I'm just going to say just a couple more minutes, and then we'll turn to audience questions. And if you do have questions, please hand myself or Lynn a card, and we will continue for another 15 minutes or so. Thank you.
Okay, so we have time for any final comments. Anything that any of you wish more people knew about artist books or thought about artist books or any last words, or do you want to go to the audience questions?
Questions are fine.
Questions are fine. Penny, are you ready to go?
Yeah, questions are good.
Sure. But before I go, something struck me when you said about Art Institute and how people are really into doing things with their hands in a way to create something. Somebody who will go nameless, I showed a book that I made recently, very small book, and she said, Penny, this is really great. You can letterpress it. And to me, that was a very strange comment in terms of, is it the process that's important that you letterpress it and that it looks exactly the same as the one I made, which was printed on Epson? And so that's to me, this little confusing to me. Is it the object or the process that we're talking about?
But don't you think that the object comes to sort of tell the story of that process or in some way embody that?
No, this one, that comment was made because you couldn't tell.
Oh, I see. Oh, well, then. That's kind of
right. Yeah. So, well, it's not meaningless because
no.
I think there is certain hierarchy that letterpress is better than printing on Epson. So that's just a sort of internal sort of point in technology adoption, I think.
Yeah, but it is internal maybe to the book arts community in that particular instance, but that question of status between media extends to all aspects of books, and what I was saying at the outset about the status of the book itself as a form right now is completely shifting by in this sort of hierarchy, cultural hierarchy. So it's an interesting example of that. Okay, we have several questions from the audience, so I want to get right into them. The first one starts with a comment. We've heard about how and why you're interested in making artist books, but why do you think there's an audience for these books, if indeed there is? It's a little challenge there.
Well, we know there's an audience for it because people are collecting them.
So people are collecting them. That's a good, we could start with that.
Mm-hmm. The other thing is, over the last 25 years where I've been engaged in making artist books, it's the special collections libraries around the country that have been kind of the storm anchor and backbone of the collecting audiences. And once those special collections libraries begin to think that your work is worthwhile, they will begin to acquire it. And that's been a great source of support for me as an artist. And then you do get some private collectors. I have to say that the audience for artist books also is something like this program today. And while many of the people I see here are familiar with the artist book, I have found in audiences that I've been talking to that the light bulbs are going off in people's heads, and that it's a really wonderful experience. And if you had no other audience than that, it would be satisfying.
Absolutely. I want to second what you said about libraries and public collections. And as somebody whose books are in many libraries, you might think of that as sort of the death of your book in some way. But on the contrary, it's the way that people get to see your books, and if they're like mine and they're limited, you know, editions, and you know, not everybody can afford them. That's one way, you know, not unlike the exhibitions at the center, where anybody can come and look at artist books. Michael, did you want to add something to that? Or?
Well, only that the appeal is really widespread. I mean, you know, the name of our talk today is Amazing Intersections of All Kinds, and that's just what Book Arts is. It brings graphic arts into play. It brings applied arts, architecture, fine arts, printmaking, depending on the material, sculpture, ceramics. You know, it really is amazing intersections of all kinds, and that's how we garner such an incredible following and fascination among the public.
We have another. We have several other questions. How do design and beauty fit into electronic publications, e-books? Penny, want to start on that one?
Yes. When I was talking about my wish list, I was going to say all the technology that allows me to do that is here. It's just that we don't have access to it. But as I said, this tactile thing about books seems so important. So although I could do everything I talked about on a computer screen, then, well, it's not paper, right? Even though there are books in wood and ceramics, and you can think of Phoenician tablets as a book, somehow screen is not acceptable. So, well, right now ebook is that. It's just the screen, and it's also not really interactive. That is, as an artist, you don't have access to creating those. It just copies the page and shows it. But suppose we had electronic paper. That is, it's going to be very thin paper. Right now the one they have is about 1/4 inch thick. It's very light, and you can roll it up. And Hewlett-Packard just figured out how to mass produce that. So then if you can just roll it, but if we really press for it, I bet you they could make one that you can fold it. And then if there's demand enough, they could add texture it and smell like paper. Okay, then what you would do is open your book, and you have exactly what you have on the screen. And so that's not very far away, actually. I think a lot of it is cost. And then the tools, we need tools for artists to do that, like website making tools, make web making accessible to everybody. But in the meantime, what's wrong with collaborations?
Yeah.
You know, artists and bookmakers or writers and bookmakers collaborate. What's wrong with artists and techies?
Absolutely.
Collaborate on working on something like that. Mm-hmm. I think I got off the subject.
No, not really. I mean, the question was about how can beauty and design be a part of electronic publications. But
ebook is pretty ugly, I must say. But a lot of people like it.
I have another answer.
Yeah, please.
Over the last year or so, I've been talking about a little book called Rice Boy Sleeps. But I don't know if any of you have come across, but it's purely visual, and there are no words, which sort of goes against one of my principles, that you ought to marry word and image. But you can, in fact, find a little card in the back, and it's got a website, riceboysleeps.com. And if you go to riceboysleeps.com, you will find 2 4-minute videos, which are musical, and accompanied by very meditative imagery that you can see is reflected in this book, but is not just a reproduction of it. And I have found that integration between a beautifully done small book and the web version of it really remarkable to me, and I'm struggling with sort of where you are, Penny, is trying to figure out how to get from here to there. Mm-hmm. And collaborating is one way, but you could see that that's a direction. Now, this is done by the lead singer in Sigur Rós, which is an Icelandic rock band. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted a treat, go Google Rice Boy Sleeps, and They now are selling it as kind of a big deal. You get two CDs.
Wow.
You get a button to wear. You get a coloring book. And you get coloring pencils. For $35.
I think this is a really interesting example, and coming on the heels of what Penny was saying. There's something about the book the traditional book that it's like it's all there, it's all in there. It's a container for, and it's a totality, and that's part of how we apprehend the book. And there's definitely a desire for that containment, that totality, that embodiment that a book is, but. When you talk about new media, really what the compelling directions seem to be intersections and sort of signals sending you off in different. It's like sort of coming upon some graffiti that sends you to a site on the web, and how that combination of that place and time in the city and that access to a medium as remote as the internet. Is can be incredibly rich, and why not multiply in some way the media involved? Mm-hmm. Okay, we have a couple other questions, so I want to make sure that we get to them. This one's about selecting a subject for a book, and the question is, can you give an example of how you selected a subject? What compelled you to design a book around a particular subject? Anybody want to start with that? Mike, you want to start with that?
Sure, I can give a brief answer. I follow my passions, and my passions are science and travel mostly, and that's what most of my books are about. And actually, it makes researching the subject a joy and sometimes not even work because you just want to know everything about it to begin with.
Yeah, the verb select in that question, my first response to it was not necessarily a question of selection. It's for me personally often a question of compulsion,
exactly.
Which you really have a prettier word for, which is passion. But others want to comment on that? How you happen to center a book on a specific topic? Or
I guess I'm very lazy, so I react to titles of exhibitions that somebody says, "Well, here's an exhibition. You want to make a book for it?" And that really makes me think about the topic. That is, I can focus my mind. And I think it's very difficult to really even be creative. Everything is unconstrained. That once you're constrained, that's easier. So the recent exhibition called Ban and Recover, well, that was reaction to banning of books. Mm-hmm. But it really made me think about what does that mean. And in the end, I didn't talk about banning per se. I talked about burning of books. But that kind of things gives me sort of a start on the subject.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say the one gift you have in doing this work is that there are no constraints other than your own deep interests.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as Michael said, you come upon something that interests you and you can pursue it. There is a certain amount of passion you have to feel for the subject, otherwise you can't get through the making of the book because it's such a, at points, so tedious and backbreaking. But you finally, I've used this, and I apologize to the women in the audience, it's a lot like being pregnant. You get into it and you can't get out of it.
Uh-huh, until it comes to term. Okay, another question, are there any particular trends or stylistic elements that the Bay Area is known for in the book arts? Hmm. That's an interesting one.
Well, letterpress printing is a long held from the Grabhorns in the early 1900s through Ariane Press today. It's just...
We have an amazing... glut. I mean, I mean that in the best sense of letterpress printing. I'm sure it's a combination of historical and cultural factors that have made this such a center for letterpress printing. But that's the first thing that came to my mind as well. Mm-hmm. Other thoughts, though?
Well, I heard a statistic that there's more designers, graphic designers per capita in San Francisco than any other city in North America.
Well, there you go.
And if this is true, I think that would figure into the popularity and. Reputation of letterpress.
Well, I just want to take the other side. Letterpress is because as you can see, I'm just trying not to be controversial, but I just put on an exhibition called Polyglot, Expressive Media and Book Arts, and in that book art, I eliminated letterpress books and concentrated on the different materials that people use to create books or concepts of books. And there are a lot of those in the Bay Area that is sort of thinking outside the box or thinking outside of the sort of the traditional way. And so I think we're really lucky that there's a rich group of book artists in this area.
Absolutely. Okay, we just, in passing, answered the next question, which was, does an artist book require a letterpress element? So I'm going to move on to our last question, which works out perfectly because it's got to be our last question. Comment on graphic novels. How do graphic novels relate to what we've been talking about?
They have sequence. They have flow. Sometimes they have word and image.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I'd say is if you're thinking about the traditional book, they don't really often take advantage of a structure more than just your basic codex comic book.
Mm-hmm.
But
Michael, did you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I'd like to see more graphic artists doing artist book editions. That would be nice. We haven't seen so many so far.
What would that involve? I mean, if somebody who has done graphic novels mm-hmm. did an artist book, what would you think the difference? I mean, I don't want to split hairs in definitions, but when you say that, what do you think might happen when a graphic artist does an artist book?
That's a great question. I think that they could enhance the story through use of materials that they might not otherwise have access to. And I think that they could also reach a different audience that might not necessarily see their work. And for this reason, a lot of artists' books are also issued in a trade edition, in addition to their deluxe limited edition, to allow more access to the material.
Mm-hmm.
So I have been kind of obsessed with comic books for the past few years when I started writing and then started making books. I talked about how I sort of worry about integrating a structure with the story, and I'm really interested in integrating text and visual art so that if you take one away, you don't have a story. Mm-hmm. That is, you take away the drawings in the comic book and the frame, and then just the text on there doesn't make any sense. Or if you take out the text out of the book, then that doesn't make sense either. And the other fascinating thing to me about graphic art is what's happening in the gutter. That is, what psychologically is happening between one frame to the next that we are adding that makes that story a real story. So I think, you know, they could help us really make some really interesting books, artist books.
Mm-hmm.
And to some more amazing intersections, I would say.
Absolutely.
our grateful thanks to our wonderful panel today, Emily McFarish, Charles Hobson, Penny Nee, and Michael Portalos. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks to our audience today and our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.